This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For some employees, perks in the workplace include a coffee machine, the occasional company lunch. But at the Cary headquarters of SAS, the job perks are incredible. Subsidized childcare, a free health clinic, and a laundry list of on-site amenities, including a state-of-the-art fitness center, hair salon, a tailor, tax accountant, a nail salon. This list goes on and on and on, which is probably why SAS is consistently ranked as one of the best places to work. It is now the best place to work in the world by some accounts. These perks, along with other employee-friendly policies, like a 37.5-hour cap on the workplace and a work week, I should say, puts the business analytics software on the list of the best places to work. Jim Goodnight is co-founder of SAS, did that in 1976. He has served as CEO of the company ever since and is my guest right now. Jim Goodnight, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, good to be with you, Frank.
Tell us about the beginnings of SAS, how that you were a scholar and a professor first, right?
Well, SAS got started at NC State University back in late 66, early 67 time frame. It was developed to help analyze all the agricultural data on campus. NC State's a land-grant university, and as such, they had a group of statisticians called the Experiment Station, and so did every other land-grant university throughout the country. And over time, other experiment stations began to count on NC State's experiment station to produce software to help analyze their data as well. So we had a group of early customers and a bunch of statisticians that were scattered mainly throughout the Southeast.
This is back in the mainframe days, huh?
It was, and everybody was moving to the IBM 360 that had just come out, and we were the first to get our stuff up and running on the IBM 360, and everybody wanted to just use our stuff rather than right in your own.
I was going to ask you, is that why NC State became the place to go for this?
Well, it's just that NC State had for a number of years been sort of a leader in doing data analysis and writing software for that. I just sort of picked up the torch and went forward with it, and SAS got started, and I added lots and lots of procedures to it to make it more robust.
And what happened? How did it become a part of the institution, NC State, and when did it become kind of a private company?
Well, 1976, we had a group of our customers, our users, that had a user group meeting down in Florida. And we went down there, and there were 350 of our customers there, and we came back thinking, wow, this is a pretty popular stuff we've got here. Maybe we ought to, if we want to continue to grow, and we were really hampered from really growing anymore at the university. So we decided to leave, and we made arrangements with the university to leave. And one of the conditions is that we had to be right across the street so they could still come over and ask questions and let us help them. So.
That's interesting. 1976. What's the environment for software developers in 1976?
Well, back in those days, it was punch cards. So you had to usually one or two turnarounds a day on the machine, because everybody had to use this one big machine that really is not as fast as my iPhone in my pocket, you know. So. Computing has really, really changed a lot since those days.
What changed for you when you changed this from this institution, right, the university-based institution, to a kind of freestanding company? What are the business challenges for you in making that transition?
Well, we were able to keep all of our customers because the university had signed contracts for support contracts for the customers that we had, and they couldn't support them, so They made us take those with us, so we had to take all the customers. So it worked out very nice for us. So we had about 120 customers when we left the university, and we're able to through our licensing process bring in enough money to get us through the first year.
Did your business practices, the structure of the business, have to change any when you were standalone?
Well, it didn't change a lot. We were used to coming back every night and working late. That's the only way you could get a turnaround and get your job back and see how it compiled and how it tested. So we had to always come back after dinner and come back and work on our programs.
SAS is now a very, very large company, hugely profitable, and it remains private. It's not a publicly traded company. Why?
Well, we've never had any need for money. We've always been positive in profit every year, so we've always had profitable years now for 38 years. We've seen our revenue grow for 38 years. I think we're up 5.2% last year to just over $3 billion worldwide. We've got like 13,800 employees right now, and have very good prospects for the year. Our pipeline looks great for this year. I think we might get back into double-digit growth this year.
Ladies and gentlemen, you just heard the CEO of one of the most successful companies in the world say we have no need for money. I just want to point that out. I need to underscore that. It does get to something, too, because there was a moment, I believe, in the 1990s during the bubble when there was great pressure on you and others at SAS to go public because of what it would have meant for those early owners. And it didn't happen. But tell us about that trajectory and what it might have meant for SAS had it gone public.
Well, I was never that much in favor of it to start with. We did talk to a few investment bankers, but that's about it. It never really got off the ground. First of all, our accountants wanted a financial system that they knew how to use, and that was Oracle. And well, it took us 2 years to get that up and running. So by that time, the bubble had bust. Yeah. It was too late to even think about it.
Now, I did read an account, I believe it was Fast Company magazine, around that time, that said that when you had analysts come in, sort of Wall Street analysts giving you advice about what it would take, that a lot of the perks and amenities that you had created and made SAS such a great place to work would have to go to make SAS an attractive investment on Wall Street. Is that true?
Well, I think they did say that, but at the same time, if you look at the best company to work for in the country is Google. They're a public company. Of course, they've got over $1 million revenue per person. You know, I wish we had that ourselves.
2009 was a rough year for everybody in this country. A lot of concern at SAS, as any other company in the country, about layoffs. You made an announcement saying there would be no layoffs. Tell us about that.
Well, at the end of 2008, we started to see a number of tech companies announce layoffs. I think SAP had announced 3,000 people were going to be laid off. And our employees were starting to be concerned about that. So I thought I should get up on a webcast, a global webcast, and make it very clear that we had plenty of money in the bank and that we would not have any layoffs in 2009. Also, there was no salary increments in 2009, and I asked everybody to cut expenses, and we ended up with a very profitable year with revenue growth again. So it was everybody pitched in. I think our total expenses grew by like 0.2% that year. So we did a great job of holding our expenses down.
So you just made that appeal, and it worked. People did cut expenses.
Yeah, and it got people back to work, and they didn't worry about being laid off. That's a terrible time-wasting thing to happen is people rumoring about that and talking about that and what have you heard. And all, you know, it can just wreck a company as far as morale is concerned.
You have, you're on record, and we'll get you to talk a little bit about this, but when you're working in a place like that, turnover is very low. I think you've got something like a 3 to 5% turnover in a business that is usually what's normal for this business, 15, 20% turnover. So it's a very low rate. And you said that saves the company a lot of money.
Well, I think Jeffrey Pfeiffer, who's a Stanford professor, wrote an article in Harvard Business Review that he said, and this was 10 years ago, that our method of retaining people, our perks and everything, actually saved us about $100 million a year in cost. And that's true. If you think about when you lose somebody, first of all, you lose their productivity. All the stuff that they're working on comes to a stop. You have to spend money interviewing people. And then once you bring somebody on board, you have to train them. And by that time, you've lost about a year's worth of productivity that the person was producing that left. So I think it's far better to retain employees than spend money recruiting them. I always say I'd rather spend money on my employees than on a headhunter.
There you go. Well, is this because of the industry you're in? You're in a knowledge-based industry. Is this scalable or applicable to other industries, retail, other industrial-type businesses?
Well, I don't think people are any different from one industry or the other. They enjoy a place to work that where they want to come back every morning, come to work, and that's the way SaaS is. We have great perks, but really I think the most important thing is our culture of innovation, where we're always looking for new things to work on, and people are all the time are coming up with new ideas and doing presentations on those. As a matter of fact, we're at a point right now I need to try to slow some of that down. We're getting so much innovation that we need to put a little bit more process behind some of the stuff that's being produced.
You need to start a head stop program at SAS. I'm talking to Jim Goodnight, CEO at SAS, and our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS, the Cary-based business analytics software company. Talked about the early days of SAS. It has since grown to a multi-billion dollar corporation. What's the kind of thing, how have things changed in terms of your product? What kinds of things are you working on?
Well, I guess in the last 4 years, we've been concentrating on products that do most of the work in memory and keeping everything in memory as long as we can. Input and output, the reading and writing from disk, is so incredibly slow compared to the speed we have internally that we don't ever want to read anything from the disk if we don't have to. So the idea is to put everything you have into memory, leave it there, and then bring the analytical tools in and out of memory to do the analysis. It used to be sort of the opposite. The analytical tools were in memory, and the data was always brought in and out. But we've completely reversed that. We've also gone to massively parallel computing. That means we hook up hundreds of computers in parallel and do the computation in parallel. We have to, but that means we have to break up every algorithm we've ever written, which were always basically sequential algorithms, and you've got to figure out how can we do this process in parallel so that we can spread the work across many.
All right,
computers.
So let me see if I understand this. You've got a job to do, and you want to get an answer. You can do it one step at a time, or you can break up those steps and say, well, look, I know I have to get to this part of the equation and that part of the equation. Why don't I have you do that part? You do step four, and you do step three. And then come together. Am I close here?
Well, pretty close. But actually, what we do is go inside each step and figure out how to parallelize it, put that step in parallel. Building up a matrix, we will assign different computers to build different rows of the matrix. So by the time we finish reading through the data, everything has been built. Just that alone allows us to build enormous matrices. You know, 100,000 by 100,000 matrix can be built in a matter of a few seconds.
Of course, just the lay analysis of what you just said, we do things in sequence because the answer to step one gets you to step two. So unless I know what happened out of step one, I can't really be working on step two yet.
Well, I think humans tend to think in sequential processes, and that's the way we've always written software, is in a sequential process. But now we have to start thinking in parallel. How can I take this problem and spread it out over many computers? And, you know, today's technology, especially that from Intel, they're producing a chip called the Ivy Bridge chip right now that's a 22-nanometer chip. And on that chip, there are 12 cores on each chip. So each core represents a CPU and everything you need to do the computation except the memory. And that the memory is separate, and you can buy as much memory as you want to put on there. You know, we put on 256 gigabytes of memory on one of these machines, so that a server now, instead of just having a single processor on it, will have 24 processors, because you've got two chips on each processor, on each board, and so there you have a total of 24. And then on top of that, you can hyperthread these these things, and you can actually double the number of processes that you can run or the number of threads. So we can actually run 48 threads on one of these machines. So now we're really talking, because all of the memory on that single server is addressable by every one of those 48 processes. And by using that in what we call a symmetric multiprocessor mode, it allows us to achieve incredible speeds. But then if that's not enough, we hook up another one beside it and another one beside it. We put 16 of these together, and we call that our sweet 16 combination. And there we have over 4 terabytes of memory that we can address. So we can put huge amounts of data in memory.
The technology is moving very quickly. Is the business model catching up, keeping up? And what I'm thinking about is this big debate over intellectual property, cloud-based computing, where we're seeing everything much more going to license and renting out space rather than owning, the Creative Commons, whether or not open source is the way to go. So much creativity. Red Hat has shown how much you can develop and even profit by open source. Is there a tension between the old industrial model of, let's say, intellectual property and what we need going forward to remain creative and competitive in this business?
Well, I think open source is fine. We use a lot of that in our software. We use the Linux operating system, and in particular use the Red Hat version of that. Hadoop is a big factor now in so many companies. Hadoop is a storage facility, a sort of a disk management system that's free. And we can store really, really big programs and lots of big data in Hadoop at a fairly inexpensive price. So with more and more data pouring in, companies are challenged to read it in, to try to analyze it, to get some results out, and that is the challenge right now that we are working on, and I think have done a very good job so far.
The other challenge, of course, is to keep up in the workforce and remain competitive. You have been outspoken about some fears, I think, that you've expressed that we're not keeping up in terms of STEM education, and more needs to be done if we're going to remain competitive.
Well, I think the President's Council on the economy has stated that over the next decade we're going to have a shortage of about 1 million STEM graduates coming out of college. So we've got to have these technical adept people, because that's really where innovation is coming from. So we have got to find a way to get our children more interested in going into STEM skills. We've got to find a way to get teachers to really embrace teaching methods that keep kids interested. So clearly, I think everybody agrees on the Business Roundtable and on their Education Committee. We all feel that STEM education is something that needs to be stressed here.
Now, that's a subject that gets addressed generally. Your wife, Anne, has been outspoken about changes in our education system and funding in education here in the state of North Carolina, and I wonder how you feel about that, about the way the education budget has gone over the past few years and what that might mean.
Well, I think the spending on education needs to increase, especially teacher salary, and especially beginning teacher salary. $30,800 is just unbelievably low to expect somebody that's gone through 4 years of college to have a starting salary of $30,800. We're not going to have any teachers if we don't correct that. Mm. I think we saw a drop in enrollment in the UNC system education departments this past year of over 800 students. And we've got to find a way to increase those starting salaries to get otherwise kids aren't going to go to college to be teachers.
I mean, class size, there are a lot of other issues that are involved in that budget that have increased class size for one. And early childhood education is another area that took a hit.
Well, all of these are problems, but none of them are going to be solved if we don't have any teachers left in the classroom. Mm. That's sort of my feeling on that.
Your main philanthropic endeavors focus on education in North Carolina and others. So tell us about that and about your efforts to make things better here.
Well, everything that SAS does philanthropically, we try to aim it completely at education. We have a group of developers and teachers that actually produce software at no charge for schools all over the country. It's a product called Curriculum Pathways. I think last year we had over 100,000 teachers that were using Curriculum Pathways. It's an online digital type of content that teachers can use and students can use to study particular areas of particular courses. I think it's the type of blended learning that more and more of our schools need to go to. It's a combination of classroom and online work. Yeah, I don't think you ever want to go just totally pure online, and we've got to find some mixture, and I think this blended learning approach is a good way to do it.
So SAS is, of course, a software developer, but you are also a real estate developer these days. We're reading about a big development plan, Chatham Park Investors. You're behind that investment. It's some over 7,000 acres in Chatham County and would radically transform what's going to happen there over the next several decades. Tell us about the project.
Well, really, that is a project that's run by Preston Development, which is run by Tim Smith and Bubba Rawls. And quite frankly, I'm basically a banker for them, and I am not involved at all in their daily plans.
You know, there's a lot of concern in Chatham County about that development plan. I mean, how do you feel about that? Given what you know about the plan, what's your sense of the impact that'll have, and the debate that it's likely to stir and already has?
Well, again, you want to talk to Tim and Bob about that because they're the experts. But clearly, anytime any residential area is being developed, there are neighbors that object to it. We've had to object to some things that have gone on in Cary because it was not good, we didn't think, for SAS. So you're always going to have people that object to it.
Well, what about this one? I mean, again, as a banker, you might be not developing, but you have to know the details or you wouldn't be putting your money in this thing. So I'm just thinking about the overall. I mean, the central argument is, look, there's going to be development in Chatham County between now and 2050, which I think is the closing date for this thing. People are going to move in. And the question is, and the developers are saying, look, do you want a planned development over 7,000 acres or do you want it piecemeal? That's their approach. Of course, what the neighbors are saying is, if you do this, you're going to radically transform our community, and what it does to the environment and what it does to the standard of living here is irrevocable. I mean, how do you sort of weigh those things? And clearly, you've backed a plan that is this kind of larger development.
Well, we're going to see Cary completely filled up. I think we're getting down in some of our last open land in Cary, and the movement further to the south and west into Chatham is a likely place that we're going to see growth. And clearly, piecemeal is probably not as good as a planned area.
Why are you investing in this?
Well, we've always backed Tim and Bubba for many years. We started, I think, back in 1991 when we ended up in owning a country club at Prestonwood. And they did an excellent job doing the developments around there. And we've had a partnership with them ever since.
What is the future like for SAS? What are the projects you're working on, and how do you see this company going forward in the future?
Well, one of our exciting projects is what we call our visual analytics product that allows you to get instantaneous results from millions and millions and millions of rows of data that's stored in memory. So we have an in-memory server that sits there and it's just waiting for the next request from a user to come in. And it answers that request in usually less than a second, ready for the next request that comes in. So the whole server has been built to surface information from large data, big data. And the user interface has been written so that it's extremely user-friendly, a very pretty interface. And it actually is leading the way for a lot of our products. So the future will have that same look and feel.
You're a mathematician. You got into this business working with NC State, as you said, analyzing agricultural statistics. You're now running one of the larger corporations in the world. Well, what have you learned as a business person? And do you? I mean, were you ready for this company? If you could you at 1976, given what you knew then, be running this company today?
I think statistics is an excellent background for running a business, actually. The fact is that statistics is about critical thinking. You've got to understand the processes, the probabilities of outcomes other than the ones you're expecting. And it's a good, very good training background for somebody to run a company, I think.
The only reason that's counterintuitive is if stereotypically, if you think about systems guys and statistics guys, they're the last people you expect to be put in a daycare center in your place or, a well-stocked commissary. In other words, thinking about the concerns that people might have who actually have to work here.
Well, daycare is a benefit. We started in the early 80s because several of the women that were working for us were pregnant and were saying they might not come back to work after they had their baby. We were very concerned about keeping women in the workforce, and we made it very clear that we were going to develop a daycare center. We were building a building, and we converted part of the first floor of that building into a daycare. So when we came up and running, I think we had about 8 kids in there.
Did you have to run any kind of analysis on this? Because intuitively you'd say, we're losing people and we're losing good people. What could we do? We could build a daycare center. But at some point you have to do a cost-benefit analysis, right? I mean, you have to say to yourself, yeah, but would it be cheaper to lose them and replace them? When you're confronted with that kind of a problem, which is a personnel issue, do you say, look, it's obvious, let's do something to keep these women? Or do you say, wait a minute, let's just run the numbers here and see how this could play out?
It's hard to put a number on any specific benefit. I guess the one benefit that I would like to get rid of, but I'm basically concerned that it would cause deep emotional problems with our employees, and that's M&Ms on Wednesdays. We go through about 2,000 tons, I believe, of M&Ms a year, or 20 tons. It's in the tons anyway. Yeah. But we're somewhat concerned as the population gets a little bit older that things like diabetes, sweets are just not that good for you. Mm-hmm. You ought to be eating more healthy things like fruits and things like that. So my management committee keeps saying we need to get rid of the M&Ms. It's just ridiculous that a company that cares this much about health, that they've got healthcare centers, they've got gymnasiums, and that a company ought to be more concerned about its employees. And I keep saying, but if we took away the M&Ms, everybody would think the company is going under.
So. Not only that, but the M&M stock just went down 3 points just now because you said that.
Well, we came up with a solution. Actually, we're copying something that Google did. They put their M&Ms in jars that you couldn't see through. Ours had always been in glass jars, so when you walked in, that's the first thing that popped out at you is all these reds and blues and yellow M&Ms. So we put them in containers that you can't see through, and I think in just the 2 buildings we experimented on, we cut down about 55 pounds a week.
Wow. So, some of this experience, I understand, came to you because you worked on the Apollo program, and your sense of how workers there were treated is something you've carried with you. Tell us about that, please.
Well, we worked in cubicles down there in Florida and, stale coffee out of a machine in the hall, and that was about it for perks. Guards at the door, if you came in late, you had to sign in and go through this different process, and your manager would have to come talk to you about coming in late. And it did set a tone in my mind that's really not how to run a company. Of course, we were used to living at the university where we were free to come in and out whenever we wanted to, and we ended up spending a lot more time working than most other people did because we did have that freedom. So when we started SAS, first thing we said, we're going to have a break area that's got free coffee and soft drinks and, some other things. So that's how we got started, and we've maintained it throughout the history of the company.
So apart from the bad coffee, what other experiences did you take from that Apollo project, and did you learn anything about team building or any other aspects of building a corporation from that project?
Well, it was more the negative aspects of it. The fact that it was very regimented. You were treated more like a factory worker, punching in on time clocks and things like that. It's just it's not something that you should do for knowledge workers, because knowledge workers can walk out any time and get another job. And as a matter of fact, as I recall, the place I worked had 50% of your turnover down there.
Wow. Wow. And, we're sending people to the moon. You'd think that'd be enough to keep you there. But the impact of bad coffee. Any advice for somebody who wants to start a company today?
Well, the barriers to entry are much lower today. You can buy a PC for $500. It's more powerful than the mainframes we used back in 76. So, that's the main reason that you have so many companies that are popping up in the tech space. The cost of entry is very low.
A lot of competition, though, at the same time.
Yes.
Exactly. Everybody with a $500 computer is now a software developer, right?
Well, there are several million in the country. So.
Jim Goodnight, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Certainly.
Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS, in a Cary-based corporation. Stay with us. There's more ahead on The State of Things. ¶¶